Hey everybody, Aaron here. Jim and I are back with another Commission podcast. This one, Rylan from the forums, who participated in the 2017 Bald Move Fantasy Football League, which is put on every year by Hatorian. We actually had enough players to fill three leagues, and every year, as is tradition, Jim and I put Commission podcasts up for grabs, which will be redeemed in the around the Super Bowl time, because you know it's a football celebration.
We need to create like a Super Bowl for TV, because I don't feel like there's anything related to television or Bald Move that's football related. Yeah. So it's a little weird that we're doing like just this. Why don't we do NBA? Why don't we do MLB? Why don't we do?
Because I'm not a fan.
WNBA.
I'm not a fan of any of those things.
Well, apparently you're not a fan of football anymore, according to you.
It's slipping.
So,
it's slipping.
Could we do like a TV Super Bowl?
I will say. First of all, that's a great idea. You should get right on that.
Oh, sure.
You should find your Hatorian to manage this enterprise and get right on that. Two, I watched a lot of football last week, and I watched both the championship games and had a blast.
Hmm. Oh, okay.
Neither result was to my liking, but it was fun. Like, it's been a good long time because I've watched two or three Colts games this year, and it's a disgrace. But seeing, like, crisp, professionally executed American football was a lot of fun. I miss it. Hmm. I miss it. I'm going to have to. I think I got the money to get like a Sunday ticket next year so I can watch all the Colts games and maybe temporarily adopt another team while the Colts are sucking to actually enjoy watch instead of hate watching. Anyway, I'm taking the glory away from Rylan. I want to read his statement on thanks. He says, I want to thank all the league mates for the very fun season and the commissioner for putting it all together. Again, Hatorian, thank you. I would also like to thank Todd Gurley for his 94.6 points in his two playoff games for pushing my subpar team to victory.
There's a football player named Gurley.
There is. Hmm. How ironic. 94.6, but the Bald Move has a fractional point system. I don't know about that. But he commissioned American Psycho 2000 film. Man, it's 18 years old now.
Yeah.
Starring Christian Bale and a whole bunch of other people. Fucking Justin Theroux.
Forgot how many people
I know
were in this thing.
I know.
That I have since come to appreciate. Like, I don't think I knew who most of them were at the time.
Right.
But I've come to appreciate them a lot more.
And he wanted us to talk about this. He's got some comments and questions we'll get to the end. Or we'll get it to the end if we don't just cover it in an organic conversation. Jim, have you seen this movie before?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is one of the first one of the first DVDs I remember watching, because I had a job at Walmart at the time, and I would buy DVDs every once in a while, because like,
right.
I worked in the electronics department, so I could just all day peruse the DVD aisles,
right.
And I'd see like, oh, this one looks kind of cool. What's the, you know, this Matrix thing? No, obviously I knew what the Matrix was, but the Matrix was one of the first DVDs, and this was one of the first DVDs, along with like The Fifth Element and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I've seen this movie before.
What did you like it, though?
Yeah, but I think the first time I saw it, I didn't know what I was in for. And so when it got to some of the stranger parts near the end, I tried to figure out a little too much about this movie.
Hmm.
And I don't think it's so much about that.
Yeah.
Like, the question of did he or didn't he is not the central focus of this movie.
Right.
Which I was blinded by it when I first saw it. This time around, I'm a little more nuanced, a little more experienced in my movie and television habits.
So I've seen this movie before, and I remember admiring some of its big ideas, but thought it was like, you know, the pacing and editing was kind of poor. So I started watching this movie, and I quickly realized, oh, shit, this is one of the many movies that I saw on basic cable. Much like Pulp Fiction,
fuck.
The fact that I could walk away. I want to talk about this for a minute. Because it's been a while. I've had a lot of personal development since I've last thought about this issue. The idea that you would butcher a film to put it on basic cable, or even worse, broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that my first exposure to Pulp Fiction was the version that they show on air, like on Fox at 10 o'clock on a Friday night or whatever. It's a travesty. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't understand why artists allow it. Like, it'd be like if you went to see Michelangelo's David in the Louvre or wherever they have it, and it has like a fucking woolly sock over his dick.
Yeah.
And pasties on his nipples.
Mm-hmm.
And like a giant, like someone has tried to paint a fucking boxer briefs on him. Like, if you want to see the art, see the art. Mm-hmm. Who? What is the market for people to want to see something like American Psycho with no blood and sex and nudity or cursing in it?
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to see that movie, but none of the things that actually make it interesting or artistic? And apparently, Teenage Jehovah's Witness boys. That's sure. the old, like thank that I thank God that I could make cultural references at all because of this cottage industry, but I don't mm-hmm. know it's worth it for people like me. I'm like,
yeah, all the value of this movie is lost if you remove those more graphic things.
Right. I mean, again, that's the thing. It's like a lot of these movies I still appreciate. It's like, wow, it's like, you know, the dialogue and like the like there's certain like big picture ideas that are kind of mind blowing that survive. But mm-hmm. all the artistry is lost. It's really, really sad. And I was getting angry as I was watching it. Like, I cannot. I mean, Jesus Christ, it wasn't poorly edited. They just had to rip 45 seconds of murder sex out of here. No wonder this barely made sense. So that was my first experience. So I feel like this is the first time I actually watched the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then now I see why it's kind of highly regarded. But I also, in my reading, found out that it's also incredibly polarizing. Like, it seems to inspire very polarizing reactions for people.
Absolutely, and especially the book. When the book first came out.
I really
want
to read the book.
Yeah. I hear it's even more graphic in its depiction of violence mm-hmm. and pornography and stuff like that. I haven't read the book, but based on the movie, I would say, yeah, it's pretty intense. And it came out, what, like 25 years ago or something?
Right.
Quite a few years before this movie did. And I think it was like contemporary with, you know, like late 80s setting of this movie, right?
Yeah.
'Cause it was meant to be, you know, about the culture at that time.
Right.
As it relates to, you know, the masks we wear and the insensitivity and all that stuff. But yeah, that's shocking to me. I think you maybe give the artist you ascribe too much power to the artist, I guess, in saying, why do the artists allow
sure.
that? They don't have any fucking control.
Right.
It's not the artist putting it on CBS. It's
no.
fucking publishing companies.
I'm surprised there's not more like... I legit feel there should be like Sarah McLachlan style puppy ads where mm-hmm. all like Quentin Tarantino and Mary Harron, the director of this film,
right.
like say, you know, show like people butcher like films getting slashed and corporations rolling around naked and money and ignorant people being spoon fed sanitized bleached art and like you know like kind of like. They do the piracy, the ludicrous anti-piracy ads for Hollywood it was all the rage like 10 years ago. Like, why can't they do that mm-hmm. for made for television or edited for television content?
Yeah, that would be pretty funny. I could also, if I were Quentin Tarantino, I would go out and I would find every syndicated, like, or not syndicated, but every airing
right.
on basic cable of Pulp Fiction.
Right.
And I would play the scenes that the audience missed in the commercial. I would buy ad time and I would put the scenes back in.
Right. Because I remember, like, Pulp Fiction, especially the entire final sequence with Bruce Willis and Marcellus Wallace
uh-huh.
is utterly incomprehensible.
I bet.
Defy
yeah.
anyone to tell a coherent narrative of what happens from the day that Zed shows up, or the moment that Zed shows up, till mm-hmm. Marcellus has got a shotgun in his hands. Like, there's nothing you can speculate about the 30 seconds of remaining surviving footage of that, like, 10-minute sequence. It's insane.
Yeah.
Anyway, I also want to talk about the director, Mary Harron, which I've not actually... realized. So I looked at her filmography, and she's most famous for I Shot Andy Warhol, which I've not seen.
Me either.
But I have seen American Horror Story this season, and it tells a story about Valerie Solanas, this radical feminist that literally shot Andy Warhol, and the Notorious Betty Page, which you've heard of. I mean, you might not have seen this. But it stars Gretchen Mol as the eponymous Betty Page, who is like this 50s style pinup but like BDSM smut model. It's a great movie. I just happened to see it two three months ago. But it's interesting because she's got this like really skewed, like all of these things deal with sexuality and violence in some ways. And I think that's kind of interesting. And I want to go see some of her. Like, there's this Moth Diaries also that I want to. That seems kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's also the.
But I was shocked when I saw a woman directed this. I thought this
and
would be,
co-writer of the screenplay.
Right.
Like, yeah, she's right. She's deeply involved in this, the creation of this movie.
And which also had me spin, because I just found out this stuff this morning, and I'm like, mm-hmm. I've been spinning in my head the whole time, like, well, what does that mean? And, like, I was prepared to dismiss the, like, whether this is fantasy or reality as, like, a plot device, but I feel like it's crucial. I want to say that what the film is saying about Patrick Bateman's insanity or lack thereof, or whether it's real or fantasy or what, is crucial to understanding what Mary wanted to say in the movie, and I haven't been able to piece that together yet.
So the interview that I read with her, and it's hilarious when I'm reading these articles, but I'll talk about that in a second.
Because I also read a really funny article with the author of the book.
Yeah, Brett Ellis.
There you go, yeah.
Brett Easton Ellis. The interview that I heard with her is that she actually doesn't like the ending. She feels like she didn't nail the tone because she left it too open-ended.
Yeah.
She wanted you to kind of not be questioning so much whether he did or didn't kill all these people. And right. She left it almost too ambiguous for her tastes.
What did she intend? Because, like, can I make a prediction?
Yeah, sure.
I predict that you're supposed to understand that his powerful Wall Street and lawyer friends just effortlessly stepped in and covered up his many crimes because they're all psychopaths, too.
Huh. That's not what she intended.
Fuck. Okay, what did she intend?
She intended for you to think that he has killed some people, at least. Not that he has not killed anyone, but that he has killed at least some people. And whether or not he killed Paul Allen was supposed to be kind of a yes or no sort of thing.
Huh.
But not everyone. Because thinking back through this movie, I was
crazy.
trying to pinpoint who could he absolutely not have been fantasizing about killing.
Right.
And I don't think there's anybody. The closest it comes is like Freddy's ribs in the alley, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Freddy when he gets stabbed right in his ribs.
Yeah.
I think maybe that's
Come on, Patrick, you're not slow bleeding me, Patrick.
Right.
You're quick bleeding me. These ribs ain't going to be no good.
but that's the one he could have killed. I don't think any of the others he could actually have killed and gotten away with it as cleanly as he did.
Huh. Yeah. Especially since, like, when he even kills, what'd you say, Jared Leto?
Yeah, Paul Allen.
He's dragging this bag, and it very clearly from the perspective of Patrick Bateman's leaving this massive blood trail.
Right.
But when they switch camera angles, that blood trail is gone. And obviously when he's loading the stuff into a trunk, like, if it was soaking blood, I think that as fucked up and out of touch as the one dude is, he would have noticed that. So it's like, yeah, I feel like there was early indications of it all being in his head.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I, like, what the hell is the movie trying to say?
In my mind, it's about, like, the sort of, it's tough to articulate. It's obviously about a very insane person wanting to fit in, and that feeding into his insanity and his bloodlust and his anger and rage. But I think it's about, like, the creation of a culture and a society that allows that to happen, or that even glorifies it. Because you look at him from the exterior and you say, this is a very well put together person. This person is the epitome of modern American ideals, right? He's rich. He's very good looking. He's in great shape. He's got it all. He's very well put together, but on the inside he is this seething, raging and in other ways, like, completely dead. Like, his insides are all fucked up, and I think that's what the movie's about, how, like, the perception of these people has become more than what they are, and in a lot of ways the toxicity of who they actually are is being glorified because of their lifestyle.
Yeah, like, the realization that I had seen the fucking bleached bullshit version of this film allowed me kind of watch it with fresh eyes, so I kind of, like, I guess liberated myself from a lot of the preconceived. So I started, like, okay, I'm gonna clean slate this, because I don't know how crazy things are gonna get. I'm gonna see, like, how effectively I can, like, identify with Patrick Bateman. Like, where does it, like, fucking break off and
almost
go wrong?
Immediately.
Yeah, because, like, because he's talking about this, like, you know, so this, he's 27 years old and he's got the self-care regimen.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, like, okay, I remember when I was, like, overcoming, like, a really rough patch in my life and being depressed that, like, self-care, the rituals of self-care, like not seeing a shower is something you've got to fucking resent because it means you're getting up and you're having to live your life. But, like, this is cleansing my body and I'm caring for my body because I deserve to be taken care of. And, like, if I don't do, like, you know, that whole thing. And I'm like, and also, like, this is the, if I'm an atheist, and Patrick Bateman probably is an atheist too, like, this is the one body you get, like, it's completely illogical the way I treat my body. Like, I love life. I want to live as long as I can and be as healthy as I can. But because I enjoy my life, I also eat too much. And I do things that don't take care of my body. So I'm probably going to be a wreck in my late 60s and 70s. Like, so maybe he's got... And then, like, almost immediately, I'm like, as he continues to monologue of, like, all this stuff and the fact that he's only 27 and he's this concerned about his aging and stuff, it's like it goes completely fucko. really pretty quickly. Like within the first 15 minutes, I lost my ability to try to identify with this guy.
Yeah. A lot of the, like, scholarly articles on the novel that I was reading were interesting because they talk about how you are the POV is Patrick Bateman's, right? So you are forced to kind of live in his skin.
Right.
Which is a very uncomfortable thing. And I think part of the backlash to the book is probably that, like, that visceral feeling of, I don't want to be committing these crimes. I don't want to be thinking this way. And the book kind of pushes you into that.
Yeah.
Which is part of its brilliance, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I do think
I feel very uncomfortable throughout this movie.
I do think this film is brilliant but I don't know how brilliant because I also don't understand some of the madness because this is about a psychopath, a sociopath, someone that doesn't feel human emotions for other people. And it's interesting because, like, there's been a couple of threads on Reddit about sociopathy, and there's always, like, self-identified sociopaths that step forward anonymously and tell you, like, what it's really like. And sometimes it's like, it's not necessarily, it seems like an affliction more than like a ticking time bomb. Like, you know, it's like they're not necessarily master manipulators, although sometimes they can be, but it's more like they're just always confused about why things are happening and why people aren't honest about the thing. Like, they just don't get some of this stuff. But so, like, when this movie makes a bunch of assertions about the fact that he doesn't feel any emotion, but he clearly does. Like, towards the end of the movie, like, he can feel emotion, and maybe that's the thing, that he can feel emotion for himself, but he can't identify that other people have thoughts and desires. But also the film, the friends that he's surrounded himself are just as unconscious and unthinking as he is.
Reese Witherspoon,
his fiance,
right,
is a fucking piece of work. The woman he's fucking on the side is blasted out of her mind on barbiturates constantly. Justin Theroux seems like he's a guy who actually has a conscience and is bothered by things, but fuck it, you know? I also like to do blow and have a bunch of money, so...
Sure.
Like, it's like, if you're a psychopath in that world, you might be forgiven for thinking that everyone around you is also a psychopath, so empathy is stupid? The concept of empathy is dumb.
Yeah, and I think maybe the one place in this movie where it separates Christian Bale's character, Patrick Bateman, from the others, from his friends... is there's one scene where they're talking about, a woman with a good personality, right?
Yes.
And they're all sitting around talking about, like, making jokes about it. And then Christian Bale chimes in and talks about how, like, he just wants to see them killed and murdered or whatever.
Quotes Ed Gein about...
Right, about the serial killer.
I want to hold her hand and be sweet, but also wonder what her head looks like on a pike.
Right. And then everybody kind of looks at him and goes, whoa, dude.
What's funny, because there's a couple places on, like, Reddit that are, let's say, hostile to women. And it's always entertaining for me to see the comments in those threads that get downvoted, like the... like You're a spout. Like, to say that women can't have good personalities is a monstrous thing to say. You're taking half of the human race and essentially dehumanizing them.
Sure, it's fucking stupid.
But then the guy who quotes Ed Gein, everyone's like, whoa, that's fucked up. It's like, it's got this, like, there are some things that are horrific, but yet you can say in polite company, and that changes. Like, you know, in you know, polite socialite Manhattan in the 1920s, it was fashionable to be a fucking racist and essentially espouse what would later become Nazi scientific theories as the way to justify that. And nowadays it's not, but there's a lot more coded and insidious ways to be a fucking racist asshole now.
Sure.
And same thing as, like, you know, like, how many of Patrick Bateman's friends would describe him as misogynist?
Probably none of them.
Yeah.
And yet he totally is.
He's the worst. Yeah. The worst kind. But it's like, yeah, sure. A guy's going to, like, dehumanize half the human race is a monster. A guy who puts their heads on pikes are slightly more of a monster. But, like,
yeah, I'm trying to figure out if that's what the author is trying to say.
Right.
Like, look, these people are all monstrous. They're not all psychotic killers.
Are you familiar with the Poe's Law that's been, like, you know, seems like it's kind of it's an internet kind of rule that's come up in the last 10 years or so?
Maybe, but I don't.
So it's the statement of the harder it, like, as satire increases, yes, that it's impossible to distinguish a true believer from someone who's taking the piss.
Right.
And I felt like that was kind of played with in this film, because when there's this scene early on where they're at dinner and they're talking about, like, society's ills, and Patrick Bateman goes on essentially a stirring kind of liberal speech about how people in the have wealth
hunger and
how you have the obligation to do stuff with your money, and he's just going on, and it's like there's a point where you're not quite sure. I mean, I think I'm sure because of the POV of the film, but, like, the people around them aren't quite sure if he's joking or not, and Justin Theroux just ends up laughing. And I feel like that's the same thing with the, you know, women can't have good personalities unless they're fat and ugly because they have nothing else to work with, versus seeing her. Like, that was another playing of, like, where that line is, and, you know, because, like, why didn't Justin Theroux laugh at that? That's is equally, I guess, ridiculous.
Right.
As a being a Wall Street guy, espousing giving back to the poor and taking care of humanity.
Yeah, no, I mean, everything that Christian Bale is doing in this movie is to fit in, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's he says it, you know, down to even, like, his reviews of music. I absolutely love those scenes.
Yes.
Because it's not because of the violence. Like, I can take her or leave the violence, but, like, the juxtaposition of the violence with his description of these albums that comes, it's not a human description of an album.
No.
It is something he read in a newspaper,
right,
or something he read in a review magazine a year ago when the album came out, and now he's just reciting it. He doesn't feel any of it. And you can see him, in the movie, like, listening to music all throughout the movie, and that might tempt you into thinking that he has some kind of passion, you know, or something inside of him that isn't just completely sterile and bland and dead. But I view that as rehearsal.
Yeah, like, it's all
he
part
is
of his
simply
mask.
Like, I need to, right, like, he takes care of his skin, he takes care of his ears here, right, and his ability to converse about music,
right,
in polite company, and
right.
It's so amazing, like, the juxtaposition of that violence with that very sterile description of the
especially
music.
Especially the, like, Huey Lewis in the News, and Phil fucking Collins, and there was, who's
Whitney
the guy?
Houston.
There's Whitney Houston, but there's also The Simply Irresistible, that's Robert Palmer?
Maybe? I don't remember.
It's like, this is, like, the most inoffensive pop
that
you can possibly imagine, and the fact that it's set to this carnage. I think the other thing that I want to talk about this movie is how very rarely have I seen something this black and disturbing that's also fucking hilarious in places.
Right.
It's very hard to strike that tone. And that's one thing I saw the book author mention, because he's got a lot of mixed feelings about it. Like, he's got a lot of problems with the end, which I can see, because I think the end is very messy. But I think this film kind of deserves a messy end. And it kind of works well for it. But he's like, a lot of people reading the book and a lot of contemporaries' reviews saw the over-the-top violence as just repulsive misogyny and, like, glorification, when I meant for it to be clear satire. And he goes, the one thing I'm glad of is that people watch this film is, like, you can't deny. Like, you might be repulsed by the violence, all that, but there is a lot of, like, really funny shit. Like, the way they filmed the showdowns over business cards.
Right.
Hysterical. The juxtaposition of him, like, casually ordering these women to eat their ass in preparation to carve him up, why he's talking about Susu Studio is funny. Like, I mean, if the science of humor is, it's like, you know, like there's a lot of, I don't know if you've read any of these like evolutionary theories of laughter. Mm-mm. That, like, you know, as these tribes of apes that we are, like, we're out in the Serengeti, we're up in our trees, and like one of us thinks we see a lion, and like we're all starting to get and then like turns out it's just a fucking pig comes out of the bush. Laughing is a way to like dismiss this cortisol spike in our body and the adrenaline. It's like it's the divergence between the expectation and the result. Mm-hmm. And that's why, like, things like laughing at a funeral, like if you can find something funny, like it's almost irresistible. Yeah. Because it's that juxtaposition.
Yeah,
and I feel like that's how this movie works. Like, we know none of this shit is funny.
Yeah,
but that makes it even more funnier.
Right, the sort of inappropriateness of it all.
Yeah.
Like, none of these things should go together.
Yeah. And how, like, there's nothing...
The fear,
like,
and the pig should not go together.
Right. No, yeah. So we laugh because we're like, oh, it's okay. But it's not... But that's the other thing that the film also comes back around, that it never lets you fully slip into that because...
Then it ends the scene with gore.
Just and really
murder.
Shocking violence, yeah. And insanity.
Yeah.
So then you're like, but then I think that just primes you for the next big laugh because you're like, oh, fuck, you know, I've been burnt laughing at this shit before.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
This is the other thing that this movie does really, really well to me is the aesthetic. I think, and I don't know how much of this is in the book and described in the book, but that all white apartment, essentially, that all black and white apartment that Christian Bale has, to me, is like the perfect reflection of his character. Mm-hmm. Because it is so sterile. It's just so bland, right? You don't feel anything when you walk into that apartment.
Right.
You feel cold and, mm-hmm. it doesn't look, alone. And
I wrote in my notes that it doesn't look like someone lives there.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a home. It's, you know, there's, and it's pretty, like, he maintains his perfection, like with the obsession with coasters and.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's like an operating room.
Uh-huh.
And
I don't think I would feel the same about Patrick Bateman if he had an apartment like Paul Allen's. You know? Like, Paul Allen looks like his apartment is a place where he lives.
But it's interesting because, does that mean Paul Allen's just a better psychopath?
Or not as much of a psychopath?
It's hard to say because every bit of their persona is completely fake.
That's true.
And and focus on externalities. And, like, mm-hmm. Doesn't Bateman say something like the inside doesn't matter or nothing? Like, at some point, like, it's like, that's how he views Paul Allen. Like, maybe he's slightly more successful. Maybe his tastes of business cards are slightly better. But he's just as hollow and empty on the inside, so he's no better than me. I don't know. That's one of the kind of takeaways I have.
Or he is better. Because I feel like Patrick Bateman is obsessed with the perception of him as it relates to other people. So,
right.
Like, Paul Allen having a slightly better business card or a slightly more expensive apartment really eats away at him.
Is one of the things we're supposed to understand.
Because his mask is all he has.
Yeah. Because one thing we see from Chloe Sevigny's character is that, or was it? Or no, maybe it's Reese Witherspoon. Yeah, she mentions that he's got a job at his father's business.
Right.
Are we supposed to understand that, like, Jared Leto's character perhaps is a self-made man? So not only is he slightly more successful, but he got on his own, which sticks. That's what really sticks in his craw?
Could be. Yeah.
Just the way that, like, I don't know this actor's name. He's a character actor. He plays at least bisexual guy. Who mistakes...
Yeah, Gavin from Silicon Valley.
Yeah, yes, that's where he said. He mistakes his attempt to murder him as seduction.
Uh-huh.
And, like, the reason Patrick hates him is because he is so obviously doesn't belong in his group, but he is, for some reason, getting away with it.
Hmm. Yeah.
Like, he's clearly outside. It doesn't belong in these big league kind of things. You know, not an interesting person, yet he is accepted in the world. And why is that? Like, why... Mm-hmm. I feel like I could watch this film a bunch more times and just do studies of individual interactions he has with characters to try. Because the other thing is...
Yeah, well, there's something interesting about that character, too, in that he is also wearing a mask, right? Like, it's not hiding the same thing. Like, Patrick Bateman's mask is hiding a psychopathic killer. The Gavin Belson's I don't know his character name, but he's hiding the closeted homosexuality. Yeah. So like they're one and the same, just hiding very different things.
And it feels like the two people that walked away from Patrick Bateman alive, the Chloe Sevigny's character, who just operated with complete naked honesty and reality. And the shit, what does he call him?
Gavin.
Gavin, yeah. Belt, yeah. His character, who, same way, like, or he realized that he was wearing a different mask. It's interesting. There's something interesting being said about who he spared.
Yeah, what they're saying,
they're
I'm
like,
not
they're
quite
complete
sure.
Extremes. Like one, yeah. He's like, you know, he's got no evil in his heart, but he's hiding a deep secret that he's probably ashamed of and having a hard time, and like he can't kill that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other woman, who's just so open and honest and a lamb to the slaughter, like he can't find any justification, any cynical thing to be like, well, this is why she deserves to die. So. You know, and even then, that was kind of like a roll of the dice. If that phone call hadn't happened and Reese Witherspoon hadn't blown his spot up, she might have gotten drilled in the head. So
probably is my guess. Yeah,
yeah.
That guy's name is Matt Ross, and his character name is Lewis.
There you go.
I had to look it up. It was bothering me to call him Gavin Belson.
The compliment is sufficient, Lewis. the other thing that he said about there being no real me.
Uh huh.
That's interesting, an interesting statement, too, because, like, it's something that you hear, like, a teenager espouse, you know, like they haven't fully formed, but here's a 27-year-old man who should be on a solid trajectory, and he's, like he's like the invisible man. Like, yeah, he's got bandages and a hat and a trench coat and rubber galoshes so you can see him, but there's nothing. If he takes all that off, there's nothing there.
Right.
Like, does he like Phil Collins? No. Does he like Whitney Houston? No. Does he like his clothes? No. They're just all it's almost like he's got like a demon inside of him, and that's the thing he's serving, and he doesn't understand it or
No, he's a puppet to his own self-image, you know, or not even self-image, a puppet to his own externality.
But that's the thing, like, is that a fucking enabling excuse that he tells himself, or does he really, like, that's the thing, like, how much sympathy should you have for sociopaths and psychopaths, I guess?
Sure, that's a fair question. It's kind of like, I think he actually believes it.
Or anyone that has some kind of sick compulsion as a need that they can't suppress.
Yeah, and this is where I look at things and I try and set. I'm like, where does the author end and the character begin, right? Because, like, I don't know that a character like Patrick Bateman would ever look inside him and say there's nothing there.
He's too self-aware.
It feels too self-aware. It feels like that is the author talking through Patrick Bateman's mouth, telling the audience there is nothing inside this character.
Right.
Whereas I don't think Patrick Bateman is that just insightful.
Yeah, like he'd have to have a year of therapy before he'd have that quote-unquote breakthrough, you know?
Yeah, it feels like a weird thing for that character to do.
Hmm.
But the book and the movie are trying to make a point.
I mean, honestly, all those monologues seem like they were way too self-aware for what my, like, understanding of what a sociopath or psychopath would... Especially one that, like, is born rich.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the psychopaths, self-professed psychopaths or sociopaths on Reddit, which probably means they're not even real psychopaths, right? But it's like,
right.
You know, the ones I've read, like, came from kind of normal circumstances. They were forced to, like, understand that, like, oh, like, these people, like, through empirical is essentially experimentation, like, oh, these people have their own thoughts and feelings and they need to be, I don't understand it, but I need to do these things to get the things that I want. Whereas if you're, like, sufficiently rich... You can glide through life without ever having to run up against a person that you need to convince or influence or, you know?
Sure.
And like, it's like, it just, that's the thing, like, I don't know how serious to take the film psychology. I want to take it super serious, but I want to take it as like, you know, but it could just be the author's meditation on what he thinks is wrong with America.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's primarily what it is, which I'm... Not totally. Like
the fact
I'm kind of in agreement with him in a lot of ways.
Yeah, the fact that this type of society can, if it doesn't produce psychopaths, it essentially produces people who are virtually indistinguishable from psychopaths.
Yeah,
because that's the thing. Like, the other thing is, like, when I first watched this movie on basic cable or whatever in my mid-20s, I had not traveled in a life that had led me into contact with Justin or Jason Bateman's. Mm-hmm. Wait.
Patrick Bateman's.
Yeah, Patrick Bateman's.
Or maybe even Jason Bateman's at that time.
Who is clearly a psychopath.
Yes.
since then, I've met, like, there's people that, like, are this fucking fake and not shy about it. Now, I'm not saying they're psychopaths, but they're not what I would... I have... When I meet these people, I have trouble... Like, number one, it's like, do you think I'm so stupid to think that I don't understand that you are faking an interest in me to manipulate me?
Right, right.
Secondly, what is the real you? Like, when you go home and you take off the suit and you're not trying to sell me on something, like, what, how do you roll? What television shows do you watch? Did you read comic books as a kid? Like, there's nothing about them that feels authentic and, like, that you could get to know, like, in a best friend kind of. Like, if I had a beer with this guy, what would it be like? I don't know.
Yeah.
But they definitely walk among us.
Sure.
And they definitely cluster in certain types of society in certain positions.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of – it's almost like a – you know, his thesis here is that Wall Street is like a fencing operation for these for these people who traffic in image rather than actual humanity.
Right.
It's a way for them to – it's a place for them to thrive.
Right.
And the system is set up to allow that. And it's there's something also here because, like, if you look at, I guess Patrick Bateman's psychosis, it all to me in my mind boils down to a need for power and control over other people,
right?
Which, like, at that point, you can kind of divorce the statement of the book from the intense gore and violence, right? Like, he doesn't have to be a murderer necessarily, he could do other things that would demonstrate his power over other people, which you see in movies like Wall Street, you see in a lot of other films about these, you know, high power financial people, right?
Right.
And so in my mind, that's more where this is going. Like, this is a place where this kind of behavior is encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
And the gore part, the murder part is just kind of a very illustrative way to convey that thought. It's harsher than, or it's more extreme in like a Fight Club kind of way. It's more extreme than Gordon Gekko, you know, taking this kid for a ride.
Let's talk about the extremity, because it gets to the heart of, like, you know, one thing we're gonna have to discuss sooner or rather than later is, like, how much. Because I just feel like I haven't gotten over the fact that I fucked up my interpretation of the end of this film. Because, like, how much of it is supposed to be real? How much of it is supposed to be fantasy? And
it's tough to say, because I know the book does leave it ambiguous. Uh-huh. But the creator of this film didn't want to leave it as ambiguous as she did.
I wonder why. Because, like, because I was thinking, like, you know, what's the difference between Leonardo DiCaprio's Wolf of Wall Street character and this guy? The fact that the only thing I can think of is Leonardo DiCaprio had fairly conventional masculine desires. He wanted to have sex with a bunch of women. He wanted to do a bunch of drugs. He wanted to have a bunch of nice things. He never, like he just wasn't born with whatever it is that makes you want to set little animals on fire and murder people.
Right.
But everything else about how he saw, like, you know, how he saw other people as objects or rubes to be used, like it's the exact same thought pattern. So it's like, I do think it's important to know whether this guy is a murderer or not.
My feeling
on it, understanding the film, or because else it's just a very weird version of Wolf of Wall Street.
Having not read the book, my feeling on it is he did not actually kill anybody.
Anybody.
And this has all been in his head, a fantasy that he's living out.
How would he control, like, how does he maintain, I guess my question is, how does he maintain the control to not kill him?
Kill
any of these people, because
these,
like,
people?
He's so insane, and he's got these urges. Like, it feels like a remarkable sense of self restraint, or a very effective sense of fantasy that protects the people that he doesn't. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I'm just trying to, like, go by the context clues in the movie, and to me, everything to do with Paul Allen and the prostitutes and the model, like, all of those things are not real because, like, of the apartment stuff that happens.
Also, Willem Dafoe.
Right.
Does he exist?
Yeah. Because I think Willem Dafoe exists,
but he got the alibi completely wrong. Or is that supposed to be a sly payoff to the fact that no one knows who Justin Bateman is. They're always confusing him for other people.
Yeah, there's something really weird. I don't even know that Patrick Bateman exists. Patrick Bateman might be an alter ego, some kind of personality that he's come up with in his head.
Right.
And that, like, some form of schizophrenia or
something.
And he's
so crazy that he thinks people are slighting them when they're actually using the...
Right.
Like, he's like... Because this feels very similar in DNA to, like, the talented Mr. Ripley.
Uh-huh.
And that's the same kind of thing where, like, eventually the Matt Damon character, the Mr. Ripley, he has told so many lies to so many different people that he can no longer keep the thing straight, and he has to start killing people to preserve his, I don't know, whatever.
Right. No,
I'm very Crocodile from Black Mirror, too.
I'm trying to go back to the first time I saw this and think, my feeling was, I'm very fucking confused by Paul Allen's apartment. Mm-hmm. Because as it's portrayed at first, you know, he does a lot of killings in that apartment, and he chases the girl completely nude down the hallway with a chainsaw, drops it on her in the stairwell. All things by my feeling should have got him caught. And then when he comes back to the apartment, it's completely empty. And the realtor who's there doesn't even acknowledge that a Paul Allen exists. So... How do you reconcile that with any kind of idea that he has actually killed any of those people? I can't. So yeah. In my mind, it has to be all of that was in his head.
Yeah. I wish I... Yeah.
And then you combine it with kind
that
of the drawings
right.
that Chloe Savini finds in his notepad or his schedule or whatever.
Right.
And you can see, like, all of the things he was purported to have done on film drawn out in this sketchbook. And I think... That's, you know, that's him living it out. That's him making his fantasies so vivid that he's writing them out. And I just don't think he kills any of those people. The only person I could see that he would have actually killed was Freddy, the bum in the alley where he mashes his cat, like,
yeah,
just or stomps
it. His puppy, right?
His puppy, yeah, his puppy.
And he's going to murder that cat.
He's
going to
shove the cat in the ATM.
It also isn't. So he kills, there's other hint, I think maybe, but I wasn't able to watch it too. I wanted to rewind it. I'm like, I don't know. I just, you know, like I gotta kind of like you take this in the spirit of the project, but like he walks into a building, which I think is the building he works in.
Uh-huh.
And someone calls him Mr. Smith.
Uh-huh.
And he shoots him
in the head.
And then he runs out and then he runs around the block, but he runs into the same building, doesn't he?
Exact same building. Yeah.
Okay. So there, that's like. I wasn't sure that the joke was that there's so many different identical firms, and this is yet another of the movie taking a piss at, like, no one, his mask is so effective that he's just mistaken for a bunch of
identity.
Different people.
Yeah. Like, of all those people, sure.
Because when they showed, that's the thing about all these people is when they first established that joke that Jared Leto had mistaken him for someone else, he points out how they all go to the same tailor, they all have the same hairstyles, they all wear the same fucking tortoiseshell glasses kind of thing.
Yep.
And I'm like, well, maybe, yeah. But, yeah, your theory about it being aliases feels compelling to me.
And then I just can't imagine he doesn't get caught for the crimes that he commits on his rampage when he you know, screams the confession onto the answering machine. And then he goes in the next day to that restaurant, to that lounge or whatever, and he talks with his lawyer who says, I had lunch with Paul Allen in London 10 days ago.
Right.
When he was supposedly murdered by you. So
see, I took that with especially the way he had that dead-eyed look. And also with the real estate agent a fantasy too? Because to me, I took that as a really good lawyer. Like, he sent Mr. Wolf there.
Oh, boy. Maybe.
And maybe. And then when he tried to talk, he's like, look, you're fucking this up. I've taken care of everything. I've even got your back for alibis. Now go fucking
shit.
Yeah, we all murder some prostitutes and Wall Street fuckers. Who cares? Like, that's the thing. Like, I so fundamentally misunderstood the end of that film. Hmm. Or maybe I didn't, because, you know.
Yeah,
that's the other
possible.
Thing is the guy, I read another interview with the guy who wrote the book where he says, I'm so deep into this thing of Patrick Bateman being an unreliable narrator that I don't even know what is fact and what is fiction.
Huh.
Which I think am I watching a writer just masturbate in front of a reporter? Like, oh, God, yes, I'm a fuck, I sound so smart. Oh,
I'm
yeah.
such a good fucking writer. Yeah.
And, you know, like, it's like, I don't know.
I did read an interview with him where he said he never decided whether or not Patrick Bateman has killed anybody.
See, speaking of psychopaths, I can't imagine being that, like being the creator of something and just like, yeah. your mind naturally wanders. I wonder what I think of this situation. Nope, I've got to maintain my art. Maybe that's why I'm not an artist.
Yeah.
Because I just can't believe people that say, oh, fuck no, I wrote this thing and I shipped it off to the editor and I haven't thought about it since.
Yeah.
Like, I can see saying I won't say because I think that compromises the experience as a viewer and the impact that this art has on you. But to just be like, oh, I haven't given a second thought. Fuck you.
Or I've given it a lot of thought and I haven't come down on a side yet. Like, I can't imagine as the creator of something that I wouldn't have a definitive right. answer to a question in my head.
Right.
That I have at least thought about. And even if I'm not willing to divulge it to you, like you said, I'm just not willing to say it.
Or you might be two minds of it. Like, I can tell, imagine. Here's the arguments for and here's the arguments against. And I, in my creative process, I thought about setting up those horns of a dilemma. And that's why, you know, that's the fucking engine that makes the thing go, man.
But if you're encouraging, if the point of the novel is to encourage the questioning of that, I would think you as an author would have to at some point have come up with an answer in your own head for you because that's what you're encouraging the audience to do.
Right.
So to not do that feels like you're not engaging enough with your own material.
The other thing I want to talk about, there's probably lots more, but I want to talk about Chloe Savigny, who has been in the news lately for being one of the very early whistleblowers on the whole Harvey Weinstein kind of rape culture going in Hollywood. And as a result, got effectively blackballed and got the prime of her career stolen from her. I've never really thought one way or another about Chloe Savigny because I haven't seen a lot of the stuff. And the stuff that I did see her in, like I remember very clearly seeing when I stopped being a Jehovah's Witness, and I'm like, I want to see some of this art house shit I've been missing. And and one of the things that had been in my mind that I heard a lot about was Brown Bunny. And I watched that, and it was such an incomprehensible, like everything that all my prejudices about art films were about.
Uh-huh.
And she was kind of in that, and I'm like, huh, okay. But I thought she was like really amazing in this film.
Yeah, she's good.
She does a lot of really awesome work, especially in that scene of her in an apartment. And I was so scared for her. I realized like how like effective that she'd set up this character. And I'm like really chagrined I guess I'm just saying that like it's a damn shame that fuckers like Harvey Weinstein tried to ruin this woman's career because she's really good at it.
Yeah, that is absolutely a shame.
And you think like how many other talents have we turned away because of this tolerating of this bullshit?
Yeah.
All right, that's depressing. and still ongoing.
Can we talk about one of the other actors in this film?
Yes. Who do you want to talk about?
Christian Bale.
Okay.
So I have a weird, complicated relationship with Christian Bale.
Okay.
Because I think he is a very good actor. And I've seen him in quite a few things where I've gone, yeah, good performance, Christian Bale. But I always tend to think of Christian Bale performance as a Christian Bale performance, not as, like, he kind of transformed into this character in the way that, like, I don't know, some other really good character actors can.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking back through his filmography here, and he's got a lot of stuff where I would say, yeah, he's just kind of being Christian Bale in that movie. But then there were a few standouts in my mind, one of which was The Fighter, where he played this the brother to like a really broken down, it was either alcohol or drug addicted brother to a boxer.
Yeah.
Who was kind of just a big drain on him the whole time.
Just a washed up, holding him back, but yet this time talking about how vital he was, kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that.
And that's one where I feel like he really transformed, not physically, but like as a character.
I think you're on to something because it's funny. I've seen a lot of Christian Bale from like Empire of the Sun,
yeah,
where he played a 14-year-old but clearly recognizable Christian Bale doing Christian Bale things. Like, and he's very virtuous and noble and heroic in like Newsies, and he plays, of course,
seen that.
Batman, and he's the Machinist, which he's just a really fucking skinny Christian Bale, and then he plays the fat washed up guy in like American Hustle, but he's still like, that's just the inverse, that's the opposite of the Machinist, where he's just really fat and out of shape Christian Bale.
Right.
Like, I when I think of like good character actors, and I think of like Gary Oldman and how transformative he is. Like, it's like you can't believe that the guy who plays Dracula is the same guy who plays Zorg from Fifth Element, who is the same guy who's Commissioner Gordon, who is the same guy who is
right.
Plays Sid. Didn't he play Sid and Sid and Nancy?
I don't know.
Like, he's got all this, like he just disappears into the role.
Or like Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Or Philip Seymour
like
Hoffman, perfect
those
example.
Kinds of guys, yeah.
Christian Bale, he's Christian Bale, but he's a very malleable thing because he can be a noble, heroic, or he can be a crazy psycho, or he can be, but they're all recognizably him. And he does most of the same techniques that, you know. I don't know what it is about. It's
like
a remarkable
him.
Range for such a small band of performance. Like Harrison Ford's very similar.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got his hair. He's like, you know, he's got an effective power band where he does most of his good work. But like, I don't know.
But you're still watching Harrison Ford.
You
you're
never
more
forget
than the
you're
character.
Watching Harrison Ford.
Right.
And that's why you cast him, because he's Harrison fucking Ford. John Wayne's the same way.
But yeah, I mean, this character is almost indistinguishable in the performance from, like, Batman, right? And it's funny because, let's talk about this, when I was reading all of the articles about this movie, and I'm like, oh, what were the reviews? What is the movie about? Like, all the stuff. Every time it said Bateman, I've read Batman. I'm like, wait, Batman doesn't kill people. What are you Oh, Bateman.
Right. You know, I had a similar, because I was watching this, and it's been, you know, the Christian Bale Batmans have come out since the first time I watched the shitty made-for-cable version of this film. And what I was struck by, how much Bruce Wayne, or how much Patrick Bateman is in Bruce Wayne.
Yes.
Like, there's this scene in the original Batman where people start saying, well, what do you think? They're at a fancy dinner party, and they're like, well, what do you think about this Batman character? And Christian Bale's like, I don't know, guy running around, punching people with a mask. He seems kind of crazy. Seems like a crazy man. He's almost identical to the Justin Bateman at this dinner party bloviating about world peace. And I'm like, is that because Christian Bale is Christian Bale in all of his roles?
Right.
Or was he trying to say something about Bruce Wayne is the same as Christian Bale? Or, I mean, I'm sorry. Bruce Wayne is the same as Patrick Bateman. He is a mask that
in a
hides
lot of ways.
A very psychotic, damaged persona.
Absolutely.
Which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
That he would bring that awareness of a character into another character to build to build upon it. Because
no, it's all very fucking confusing, especially when it's Batman and Bateman.
Yeah.
I couldn't. I just kept getting confused.
Patrick Batman.
Yeah. the other movie I really thought Christian Bale was transformative in is The Big Short. He plays like this.
Yeah.
Wall Street guy, but in a very different form. Like, he's the number crunching, like very conservative.
Yeah.
All about the profit margins and stuff. Like, he's really good in The Big Short.
Right, right. You know, I mean, his problem is he's just too, like, Gary Oldman is, no one would say he's an unattractive man.
Sure.
But he has got, like, you know, he's also got a lot of, like, this is the default setting for a white man kind of things. Whereas Christian Bale is crazy attractive, I think, and also and kind of unconventionally so. He's got a lot of weird things going with his chin and his teeth and his eyes. But
his smile is a little weird
and
for
like
me.
Very Julia Roberts, like any individual thing might be like, oh, this is too much, but it somehow fits together on their face. And it reminds me of a lot of like when I see him in American Hustle and he's, you know, gained 50 pounds and he's done the Pete Campbell thing where he shaved his own head so he looks like a balding schlub. Mm-hmm. It reminds me a lot of like Anne Hathaway in the early goings of The Princess Diaries, where you're supposed to understand that Anne Hathaway is not smoking fucking hot. because she's wearing a dumpy sweater and her hair is pulled back and she's wearing glasses and she's made up to look like she's not wearing makeup. Mm-hmm. I'm like, come on. I feel like that's maybe his problem is that he is just so fucking charismatic and attractive as Christian Bale that, yeah, he can be skinny, fucking charismatic and attractive and weak Christian Bale, or he can be fat, out of shape, past his prime, but he's still like... You know, you can see the makeup on him.
You're forgetting Reign of Fire, Christian Bale,
which sure
is still just standard Christian Bale.
Yeah, he's
the one speed version of Christian Bale.
Yeah, no, right. That's his post apocalyptic heroic, ennobled Christian Bale.
There's Equilibrium, which is also a great movie.
Equilibrium is a great movie.
He's a star of that.
What's interesting about that is I'd have to see that because it's been a while since I've seen that movie.
Yeah.
But he plays kind of like a deluded rube throughout the most of it, which is not something that I usually associate in his Christian. Like he's almost like a childlike, like Leon the Professional type character.
Shit. I don't
he's
remember
He's been
that
taken
movie
advantage
well
of. Like usually I associate his roles with like some kind of intelligence and cunning, whereas in this he's completely guileless and... Mm-hmm. A true believer and, you know, deluded fool.
Yeah.
Like I said, he's got a lot of range. It's just all Christian Bale range. So maybe that's even more impressive than Gary Oldman, you know, making out with Keanu Reeves and saying, I'm a vampire. I mean, I don't know.
310 to Yuma. We watched that.
310 to Yuma, fucking great.
He was great in that.
He is out on the Old West trying to get a criminal on a train, heroic, ennobled Patrick Bateman.
Patrick Bateman.
You know what's so funny is like when I was watching this, I thought I was having a unique and original and penetrating thought about Bruce Wayne's connection to Patrick Bateman. And then, like, the almost immediate thing I started uncovering my research is how well-trod that theory is.
Oh,
like, there's YouTube videos about it. There's, like, 40,000-word essays about it. It's like, shit. Thought I had an original one.
Yeah. So here's the one thing that I wish that I think would have connected me more to this movie in a traditional sense. Because I do think the movie is brilliant for what it's doing. I would have liked to know a little bit more about why Patrick Bateman is the way he is. Like, what made him into this monster?
What if he's maybe... Yeah, because, like, either what if he's just, like
is
there's
it,
nothing. Like, he's just born
has he,
that way.
Right. Has he always been this crazy, or is it, like, the chase of this perfect image that's made him that way? You know, like, what does it say about how we are producing people like this in society? As
or
opposed to
just
like how we're
that's what I'm saying, like
we're housing them.
My feeling from what I've actually read on the subject is that this is something you're born with.
Okay.
And it maybe it's hereditary, so like it can seem like, you know, like if you've got a psychopathic mother or father, then you're gonna have probably a pretty fucked up, untraditional childhood. But like no amount of like torment and abuse can make someone psychopathic. You can make them traumatized and like a lot of other things, but you can't make them like a fucking psychopath. I don't know if that's true or not.
Sure.
That's just what my understanding from my layman's understanding of the reading I've done of late on the subject. But don't take that to the bank.
Well, then maybe we could have seen, you know, his parents. What are they like?
Yeah. Like they they're alluded to, like, you know, he's not like, cause if they didn't mention his father, like he could just have sprung out of like the fucking ground fully formed, you know, because there is no past there. There's no ethos. There's no like even appreciation, like real appreciation of art or culture. The things that like we kind of, I see in other people as, you know, when you're trying to make connections with people, right? And like, oh, is this person I'm going to be friends with or not? Like, there's nothing for you to latch onto there with him.
No, there's not even like a reflection from Bateman himself on like why he thinks he's this way.
Even
you know,
his,
it's,
when he
it's
talks
just,
about, yeah.
it's matter of fact, I am this way.
When he talks about his school, like, there's nothing meaningful about it. It's just a shallow, it says he's a Harvard guy and he makes a shallow... hackneyed observation about Yale men.
Uh-huh.
Like, there's nothing distinctive or personal about any of that.
Yeah. Which maybe that's part of the point. You know, you want this character to be sort of a black hole.
Yeah, because, like, you know, that I do feel like that that both the writer and director kind of played a little dance where, like, they want you to identify, but they, I think they both would feel like they failed if they, if people, because that's the thing, like, I'm actually surprised there isn't a segment of the dark parts of the internet where these types of people congregate that doesn't, I've never seen, like, an image meme that looks up the Patrick Bateman the way you do see, like, Ed Norton and Brad Pitt. Oh, well, yeah, especially that, but Brad Pitt in, like, Fight Club.
Right.
Where, like, dude bros see that fucking film and completely take the wrong message from it and see it as a prescription for, like, the truth, the true authentic way to live your life. Like, mm-hmm. I'm actually kind of shocked. Or maybe there is a gallows humor part of, like, the Wall Street bros that have posters of Patrick Bateman, ironically.
Yeah.
The same way some of these people, like, post Nazi imagery, ironically. And, you know, it's like, it's Poe's Law, right?
Have you seen Boiler Room?
I have not seen Boiler Room.
Oh, man, that's a good movie. That's
Damon?
No. It's Vin Diesel and Giovanni Ribisi. And it's Vin Diesel in, like, a serious dramatic role. He's actually really good.
Is Vince Vaughn in that, too?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, he is. I think so.
I thought sure Matt Damon is in that, too.
Ben Affleck's in it.
Ah, well, there you go.
Yeah.
His brother.
Right.
No, I have not. I want to see movie. That. I want to see that.
I might be confusing Vince Vaughn and Ben Affleck in that role. I'm pretty sure it's Ben Affleck.
Yeah, no, it is. I just looked up the cast. It's definitely okay. The big three. You're right there. Vin Diesel, Ben Affleck, and Giovanni Ribisi.
Yeah.
There's no Vince Vaughn to be found.
That's another good Wall Street movie. This movie is not really about Wall Street.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not about Wall Street, though.
It takes place in a setting that revolves around Wall Street, but I don't think this has anything... I don't know. I guess it does have something to say about Wall Street.
Mm.
Yeah.
What else do you want to talk about? I mean, I want to highlight the... What do you think is the best scene in this film? Or the most impressive... Maybe the best scene or slash most impressive performance by Christian Bale.
Oh, well, when you put it that way, it's the confession scene.
Right.
That confession scene is a great piece of acting.
It really is. Of something like I'm not... Usually when I say something's a good piece of acting, it's because they've put me in the place and moment to identify exactly that feel. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is like... It's essentially watching a xenomorph from Aliens losing their shit on the telephone.
Yeah.
But even though I don't know what that would look like, I think it looks exactly like this, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what a psychopath feeling empathy for their own lost humanity would feel like, but I bet it's exactly like this.
Yeah, no, it's a complete breakdown of that image that he's been trying to build, right?
Right.
It's everything that he's been... Maybe not even actively suppressing, but that hasn't been surfacing in that moment. But
not because he's a bad guy, but because he's not going to be able to do it anymore.
Right.
Like, there's that kind of, like, this genuine emotion, not over any contrition or... Like, it's a trite thing to, like, well, are you sad because you actually realize what a terrible person you are? Are you sad because you got caught?
Sure.
Like, this is the epitome of sad because you got caught.
Yeah.
But it's pretty effective.
And I would... In some movies, I would ascribe, like, overacting to this moment, but I think it's earned. Like, the idea that this guy is a psychotic personality. A lot of the stuff that he does early on builds to this. Like, when he kills Paul Allen, that's the other standout scene, in my opinion.
Well, Paul.
Right, just the way, the fun he's having, right? The way he's...
And what a dope Paul Allen is. He's going to sit in his chair, got all this carefully duct-taped newspaper underneath him.
He's very drunk at the time.
He is very drunk, and maybe even drugged, because we see that Patrick Bateman has a couple plays out of the Bill Cosby playbook.
Yep. But yeah, that all leads into this truly unhinged performance when he's confessing, and I think it's brilliant.
I do too.
Those are my two favorite scenes.
They also, there's this character, actor, Kara Seymour, who plays the prostitute he picks up and brutalizes and then talks her back into. He's the one that he ends up chainsawing to death.
Yeah.
She's really good.
One who sort of looks like Uma Thurman, maybe.
Kind of, yeah. Like Uma Thurman and Elizabeth Moss got mixed in a blender.
Okay. Yeah.
She was one of the best things in The Nick, the first two seasons, the only two seasons of The Nick. She played this disgraced nun who was disgraced because she helped women get abortions back when that was super frowned on. So I thought she did really excellent work, and it's funny because like Reese Witherspoon, like, is it good or bad? Like, she's just playing like the most generic, legally blonde,
clueless
yeah. type of like. That's not even her film, and she's playing that. She's playing that.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if it's good or bad. She's doing what the role requires.
Yeah, and I don't know. In that, it's pretty good.
Shall we? Like, I think now we should bat clean up. We should go over to Ryland's feedback and see what he has to say. He goes, "This is one of my favorite movies. I'm extremely interested in your feedback on Christian Bale playing Patrick Bateman as a high-functioning sociopath that blends into the people around him. I have a few questions. I've heard that Christian Bale says he based his performance off of Tom Cruise. Do you see this?" That's
off
interesting.
Of Tom Cruise. Had he jumped on the couch yet?
No. But there is something fundamentally artificial about Tom Cruise. And if you ever penetrate that... Like, I'm thinking Matt Lauer's interview.
He disappears into smoke.
When I think of Matt interviews...
He's vanquished
to hell. Like, during his couch-jumping spree, he did a lot of press because he was trying to... Right. I don't know what he's trying to do. He's already...
Scientology, I think.
Yeah, I think there was this thing like, hey, it's time for us to take off our mask and let Lord Zeno out. Yeah. And...
Shed our prescription pills.
And say how, like, what a scam psychiatry is and all that stuff. Yep. And... I remember this interview with Matt Lauer where Matt Lauer is trying to, like, inject some kind of sanity. Now, funny enough, turns out Matt Lauer is a fucking monster who had, like, a fucking rape room in his studio, in his office in the NBC studios for years and years.
Hmm.
Unbeknownst to no one. So we're watching two psychopaths duel.
Yep.
And, like...
Jesus Christ.
It's a shit show! This fucking entertainment world we live in is a shit show, man.
I'm laughing right now in the same way I laugh when Christian Bale flips on Genesis and murders two prostitutes.
Like, I remember thinking, like, wow, look at Matt Lauer taking to this crazy dude, and he's just as fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway... There's this point where Matt Lauer's really pressing it, and fucking Tom Cruise snaps, and that... Nice mask falls off, and you can see him for, like, the fucking probably son of a bitch he really is. And then it goes snaps back into place.
Mm-hmm.
I would totally buy it. I'd totally buy it.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think if I'm being nice, if I'm being generous to Tom Cruise, I would say everybody has a point.
Sure.
Where they're pushed beyond it, and they have to become an asshole for a moment.
I'm not proud.
And that doesn't necessarily define them.
That's true.
Yes, there is something... About the nature of Tom Cruise's job, I think, that requires a certain artificiality, much like Patrick Bateman. And
I guess that's the thing. Like, I would hate for someone to see me at my worst moment and be like, oh, there's the real A-Rod.
Right.
But on the other hand, I don't think anyone could accuse me of, like, putting on a front of just bland congeniality charm. Like, that's not kind of my game,
that's
man.
Not what we do here at Ball Move.
No. So, like, I guess, like, since I my public persona is a flawed human being that tries mostly to do right, like, if I got in an angry argument with Matt Lauer, people wouldn't be like, oh, fuck, there's a real psycho, dead-eyed, mackerel face killer that we always knew you'd be. Whereas Tom Cruise, like... Who's Tom Cruise's childhood friend that's going to step forward and say, I've been with him from the beginning, and he's, you know, he's a weird dude. He's a weird dude in a weird religion.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Moss, there's a big conversation on, you know, on the forums, because I always forget that Elizabeth Moss is a Scientologist, but...
Oh, really?
It is kind of mind-blowing to see her playing a woman in this repressed, abusive religious cult when she is, in fact, a woman... In this repressed, abusive religious cult.
Wow.
Let's get on the next one. What is Bald Moose's business card font type, and how about your white face? Mm. First of all...
I definitely like the color bone. Bone's a good color.
White face, super racially inoffensive.
Yes.
So let's not talk about that.
Would you have any embossing? I feel like...
You know, here's the thing is, Bald Moose fonts are what is known in industry as essentially basic bitch. We're like Arial, Helvetica...
Yeah,
is like what is the actual what is the actual Bald Moose font?
We actually, for the most part, I've been using like GT Walsheim.
Oh, that's certainly...
Yeah, which is not a standard font.
Right.
I feel like we've remade
the Bald Move logo enough times.
We have.
And so it's like slightly different. Because I'm always trying to ape your fonts. And what I'm going to do, call you up at 2 o'clock in the morning and ask what font you use when I need a crisp logo.
Yeah, they're all installed on the editing machine. So
right.
If you need a logo, that's where you go.
And there's four dots. It's hard to...
Yeah.
We've
had business cards in the past.
We have.
And they were nothing like the Patrick Bateman business card.
They were hilarious.
Yeah. There were a lot of bad ones, a lot of dumb ones.
There were a lot of inkjet-generated printed ones that had like edges that seemed like they were just like punched out of cardstock.
Or hand-cut by scissors, perhaps.
Yeah, let's put it this way. Patrick Bateman wouldn't see my business card and want to kill me.
No.
So
no, I think no jealousy there.
I think I'm doing all right. What do you think about the ending, especially the narration, exploding cars? I think we kind of talked about that increasingly it seems like the worst parts of this movie are just Patrick Bateman's fantasy.
Yes. And in my mind, certainly.
That's where, like, the 1-2 punch of him going into his own building and seeing a different guard that he hadn't shot and then going out and having a shootout with the police where he won and blew up a car.
Uh-huh.
Like, yeah, that's got to be. But I guess my question is, when did it stop being real? And I, you know, it feels like I would like the movie less if I could conclusively prove that no one died. Mm-hmm. And I'd also like the movie less if someone was conclusively able to prove that everything was reality, including the explosive shootout with the police.
Yeah. No, the ambiguity serves this movie well.
It's got to live in that kind of uncanny valley, right? What's your read on Willem Dafoe's character?
What do you mean read on?
Is he real? Or because the thing Willem Dafoe's a weird guy, too. Like, there's a couple points where he, like, widens his eyes and he's, like, Antichrist mixed with Green Goblin Willem Dafoe. And he's, like, semi-satanic as he – and I think, like, oh, man, he's going to – he's got a bead on – he's got this intuitive bead on Patrick Bateman and it's going to be his undoing. And it never happens.
Right.
And I think, huh. Is that telling me that he's interviewed all these Wall Street guys and Patrick Bateman did not stand out as being like, is the, because that's an interesting thing for the movie to say.
You know what?
All these guys are fucking weird. So like Patrick Bateman didn't stand out for being exceptionally weird or setting off any of his bells.
Right. Like a lot of people are saying, okay, these confused identities are really just a result of how similar everyone is. But I don't buy that because human beings can recognize other human beings very well.
Unless they're all sociopaths, which could be one of the theses of the movies.
I think I'm coming down on the side of fucking Green Goblin. What's his name? Willem Dafoe.
Mm-hmm.
Not being real. And I think it's because he calls him Patrick Bateman. Because I don't think Patrick Bateman is a real person. Because when he's talking to his lawyer, he calls him Davis or something.
Right.
Patrick Bateman, to me... Well, shit. I mean, doesn't Reese Witherspoon call him Patrick every so often?
Yeah, but that could be one of his many. That, I mean, that could be one of his many aliases.
Hmm.
I don't know. Now that I've thought about it for an hour and 12 minutes, I see the holes in your thesis. But again, that might be part of if I watch this movie 5 more times and still like I can't tell exactly what's happened, I'd almost admire it more.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's something to be said for unreliable narrators and you just having to kind of like, you know, like the other work this year that last year that Justin Theroux was involved in, The Leftovers. At the end of the day, it's kind of like you got to choose your own adventure and what you think about it says something about you. Like it could be that if you believe that all this Justin Bateman stuff is fake and fantasy, then you just can't accept that there are really people like this or that fucked up. Or if you think that's all completely real, maybe your prejudice against Wall Street types leads you to believe that like there's some unique monster that you could never be because you are not a Wall Street bro type of dude. I don't know.
Well, I think there's something that is a fantasy here because the end of the movie is completely unnecessary and, in fact, intentionally confusing and misleading, if not, because... Christian Bale's Patrick Bateman has the same realization. Like, holy shit, I haven't actually been doing any of this stuff,
right.
I think. I mean, that seems the obvious thing that it's trying to say at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
So some of it has to be fantasy. I think
I mean, clearly the cop shootout where... fucking didn't happen.
Right,
no
right.
Way.
I mean, there's a moment where he looks at his gun and he's like, could that even happen? Like, what the fuck?
Right.
Or he starts to even question his own fantasy.
Right.
So some of it's fantasy. I don't know where to draw the line. And I feel like Willem Dafoe's character is an interesting question. Like, is he or isn't he real?
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough to tell. I have to see it again, I'm sure.
He also asks, why do you think someone with such a blatant lack of empathy, such as Patrick Bateman, who could go on to hurt so many people, can fit into society so well? Do you have any theories on
because
that?
Because society is broken. Well, it encourages things that are easy to fake.
Well, the other thing is, like, it's actually hard to take stands for anything. Like, it's like, you know, I was talking about Poe's Law and... What I've realized is sometimes when I very strongly state a philosophical or political opinion that I strongly hold, and I think it's even based on evidence, I realize that the more forthright and emphatic I state that, the more I sound like a caricature of someone making that argument. Like I could, all I have to do is put 5% more spin on this, and I'm making fun of the thing that I'm passionate about.
Right.
And every time I do, I feel like I can hear in the back of my head all the arguments against what I'm saying, because it's not like in any particular political or philosophical or religious truth that you would espouse, there's always problems. There's always like, yeah, buts, or what about this, and you can get paralyzed by that. And I think the sociopath superpower is they float above all that. That none of that shit, that buzz that's in most of our heads,
right,
that tells us that we are probably wrong, that doesn't exist. And I think that's why they're so effective at this camouflage, because they're free of these weird biases and social graces to do, look at how vicious he is with the poor laundry people he knows that because of their station, he doesn't have to do anything. He doesn't have to be nice to them at all. But, someone that he's trying to get something out of, he's very, very charming. He knows exactly how much of a shit he has to give at any given time. And it's like he's got this clarity of, I guess, purpose and free from the emotional, need to be wanted and liked.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's why it makes them very efficient, predators, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think... to kind of expound on the idea that at least a portion of society is broken, I think, valuing the things that are easy to fake. He can very easily have good style. He can very easily look like he's well put together.
Yeah.
But try and get an honest human reaction out of that person, and he will fail every time. Try and get him to show some compassion, some true compassion, he will fail every time.
Right.
But we don't value those things. We don't reward those things
we
in the same way
do.
That we... Sure, we say we do, but in actuality, look at the people who are getting fat and happy.
It reminds me a lot of what Dan Carlin would say about the transition between the Roman and imperial epochs of Rome, that Rome had these ideals of stoicism and civic virtue and selflessness and valor, but what they actually rewarded were results. And what people did is they could figure out a way that I'll get results ruthlessly, and I will fake the humility and the platitudes. And, that's the thing. You're right about the system. We say that we like certain things, and there's a certain ethos that we admire here in America, but you look at the people that we reward, mm-hmm. and you look at the things that actually matter, and it's all money and bottom line.
Right.
And I don't know, because that's a lot of these problems are problems that are institutional problems, political problems, problems with just the system of capitalism,
mm-hmm.
which is better than everything that's come before it. But maybe in a post scarcity society, we should look at other things. I don't know, man. It's a great film, because I think all those questions are up for grabs.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're also no super easy answers. And painful transitions and painful painful processes to fix the problems here in society that stuff like this, this movie points out.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, Rylan asked, do we like Huey Lewis?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
I can't be a fan of Back to the Future and hate Huey Lewis, man.
You have
a house divided against itself cannot stand.
I don't think anybody got through the 80s without at least liking Huey Lewis a little bit.
What do you think about the criticism that Huey Lewis is aggressively like it's almost like Huey Lewis is the Garfield of music. Like Jim Davis, I think it's a well-known that Jim Davis cynically created Garfield as a way to get rich. Licensing and comics. It's not funny.
Sure,
it's just fucking bullshit, broad based cat humor to appeal to the fucking as the opiate of the masses.
Right.
I think you could make this argument that Huey Lewis did the same thing with music.
Sure. That doesn't make the music necessarily bad.
That's true.
He wrote a lot of catchy songs.
Just like I have chuckled at a Garfield or two.
Right. Right.
He does love lasagna.
A cat loves lasagna.
A cat loves lasagna and being an asshole, which is like my cat. It's so relatable.
And hates his owner. Yeah.
And hates his owner, right. Like, it's, you know, and the dog's a fucking stupid drill machine. Like, it's just things that most people can agree on or get angry at. Huey Lewis, I don't know. That's the thing, like, speaking of Poe's Law, it's virtually indistinguishable to tell, like, a genuine pop act that has any kind of soul and merit from a... you know, industry created machine.
Right.
Like, is Justin Timberlake actually talented?
He's a good singer.
He's a good dancer. He's a funny guy, I think. But he was also part of a very cynical pop machine.
Absolutely.
And he made his bones doing that. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can be both.
Maybe.
Fuck if I know. I'm not an artist. We've established that. Anyway, congratulations for winning the Fantasy Football League, Rylan. Great pick of a movie. I'm glad that you have refreshed my memory of American Psycho with an authentic memory of American Psycho, not a bullshit, bleached, brainwashed facsimile that I saw on basic cable one afternoon. We've got two more of the football commissions before we get back to our regularly scheduled slate of commissions. We got Prisoners 2013 and Lost Boys 1987. Both of those are going to be super fun and coming out real soon. Again, unfortunately, we're not taking new commissions right now. Until we get our existing clay, like our oldest commission is November 10th, 2016.
Ugh.
It's disgusting that we are 14 months behind on this thing. So we're not taking new commissions until we get this thing cleaned up, and we're going to decide how to go forward with that. I'm getting that asked a lot because I no longer put a link to the commission podcast thing in the commission podcast. Well, it's because we're stopped doing it for right now.
Mm-hmm.
But be looking out for new stuff to come at baldmove.com. Until we get to the next one, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And we'll see you then.